Time was, the Georgia drawl of this Atlanta lawyer was as famous as any athlete's voice in America.
The important points here are the wind-up of the hips and body, the extension of the left arm, and the cock of the wrist, indicated by the angle between the left arm and the shaft of the club. Now let's see how the backswing arrives at these positions.
Bobby Jones was America's first golfing superstar. And if that doesn't sound impressive enough, consider this. He merited not one, but two ticker tape parades through Manhattan. They said that Charles Lindbergh drew less of a crowd. Jones reached the peak of his fame in 1930, when he won the U.S. Amateur Championship, the U.S. Open, the British Amateur Championship, and the British Open. No one had a name for that feat, so the phrase Grand Slam was borrowed from Bridge to describe what he had done. Sports writer Ron Rappaport, a regular on this network, he's on Weekend Edition with Scott Simon, has written a book about Jones called The Immortal Bobby. Welcome to the program.
Happy to be here, Robert.
One thing you write about Bobby Jones is that he was a widely admired Southerner, and in the 19-teens and 20s, that wasn't a common thing to be.
No, the South was still considered a backwater, and it was amazing to see how Georgia and Atlanta in particular rallied around him. Robert, jumped onto the scene in 1916 when he was 14 years old, played very well at the U.S. Amateur, and it was astonishing to see how Atlanta and Georgia, they were writing poetry about him, putting editorial cartoons on the front page of the Atlanta papers. In many ways, he became the face of Atlanta for many, many years to come, and of Georgia and the South.
Talking about his youth, there's a photograph in the book of Bobby Jones at age six, swinging a club. His stance and setup, all of us would aspire to be able to do this as well as he was doing when he was a first grader.
Well, it doesn't hurt to grow up on a golf course and also to come across a very great teacher, a man named Stuart Maiden, a dour Scot who'd just come over, who'd literally gotten off the boat. And he taught Bobby using very, very useful advice, Robert. He would say, hit the ball hard and it'll go somewhere. He gave him very simple advice.
Now, Bobby Jones was an amateur golfer. He never turned pro. But as you point out, it's misleading to think of him as somebody who actually was making a fortune from real estate or law, which he worked in both. He made a lot of money being an amateur golfer.
Well, his whole reputation was built around that, Robert. He was held differently in a different regard from all the professionals because he was an amateur during his entire career. Yet the irony is that he made the bulk of his income from golf, writing about golf, making movies about golf. Bobby Jones Golf Club sold until after his death. He made a lot of money on it. The year after he retired, after winning the Grand Slam in September of 1930, the final tournament, the U.S. Amateur, he retired 2 months later. And in January of 31, only a few months after that, he was in Hollywood making a series of very well-received movie shorts with some of the great stars of the era, W.C. Fields, Edward G. Robinson, James Cagney, Loretta Young, Walter Huston. They were very, very popular. Robert, he made $250,000 in 1931. This is as the Depression was tightening its grip. Nobody playing golf could have made that kind of money from tournaments. So golf served Jones very well, just as he served golf very well.
So the answer to the question, why did he retire right after he became the most famous, successful golfer in the world, was it was time to make some money.
Well, that was part of it, but I also believe that he retired because the game was driving him crazy. You look at the films of Jones's swing, and it almost takes your breath away. I talked to Eric Fidian, age 93, whom Bobby beat in the 1930 British Amateur, one of the Grand Slam tournaments. And he said, you know, could be disconcerting to be playing against him. There was no question of hit the ball. It was if he swept the ball off the tee. You watch it, Fidian told me, and say, by Jove, that's lovely, isn't it? And yet, for as great as he was, it was just very, very difficult for him. Whether he would win the tournament or lose the tournament, he would come off the course, and his friends and spectators would be just appalled at his look, ashen-faced, sunken-eyed, hollow-cheeked. It was just awful. So he really had to quit. The game was just driving him nuts.
He would lose a considerable amount of weight in a golf tournament.
Well, he said that he would lose 15 to 18 pounds per tournament, which did not happen when he practiced or played with friends. It was a toll taken only during tournaments. It was strictly nervous energy.
On another matter, Jones was a Southerner, and the public course in Atlanta that was named for him was ultimately the course that the U.S. Supreme Court ordered desegregated. What did he make of segregation?
Well, here's a very interesting thing. Jones was a very political man. I read a lot of his letters, and he was a prolific letter writer. There were like 30 volumes of them at USGA headquarters in Far Hills, New Jersey. And he speaks of politics all the time.
He was writing to Eisenhower for many years.
He had a great correspondence with Eisenhower, but he was also famous for writing his congressman. He didn't care for the Peace Corps. He didn't like the King-Anderson bill, which was a precursor to Medicare. Many other political issues, he would write his congressman. He never wrote about race. And nobody I've spoken with who knew him or who's researched his career, and there have been many people who have done this, have been able to find that he ever said a word about race. I talked to his law partner, Robert, Arthur Howell, who had an office next to him for 10 years. They talked about politics all the time, but never talked about race. All we can do is infer, and some of the people who know him confirm this, that Jones believed in segregation and Southern traditions as a general principle, but not in racism or race hatred.
I wonder, having read so many accounts of Bobby Jones's matches and the way he played and the way his opponents played, if in his prime he could somehow be transported to Augusta for the Masters next week and he teed up against Vijay Singh and Phil Mickelson and Tiger Woods, you think the golden boy of the golden age of golf would actually hold his own, or has he been passed by these bigger athletes drawn from a broader field?
Well, in the first place, I'll give you what Jones would have said. He would have said you can only measure an athlete against the people of his time. He played with hickory clubs. Exercise was not in vogue in that era. O.B. Keeler, his Boswell, the Atlanta sports writer who followed him everywhere, used to refer to him as Rubber Tire Jones. He had a bit of a weight problem. On the other hand, he was extremely strong. He had a beautiful swing. If he had come along in this era and used modern clubs and modern training techniques, I wouldn't bet against him.
Well, Ron Rappaport, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Robert.
Ron Rappaport's book is called The Immortal Bobby, Bobby Jones and the Golden Age of Golf.